Can you comment on any of your positions that you've made public and what, some of them that you think are the best value right now?
Yeah, I'll mention, on the junior side, I'll mention a couple.
This episode of MiningStockEducation.com is brought to you by Sandstorm Gold Royalties. Sandstorm Gold Royalties is a different kind of gold company. They purchase royalties on select mining operations and receive a percentage of the revenue in return. Sandstorm now has a portfolio of nearly 190 gold royalties around the world. See how gold royalties differ from other gold mining investments at SandstormGold.com. That's SandstormGold.com. Sandstorm Gold Royalties trades on the TSX as SSL and on the NYSE American as SAND. Welcome back, and thanks for tuning in. You're listening to the Mining Stock Education Podcast, and I'm Bill Powers, your host. For this episode, I'm joined by Adrian Day of Adrian Day Asset Management. Adrian's a well-known investor, speaker, author, and advisor when it comes to resource investing. And as I've said previous times on this podcast, Adrian wrote the first book that I ever read on resource investing and helped to pique my interest in this niche sector. Well, my last interview with Adrian was about 2 years ago at PDAC 2017, but Adrian joins me again today. So Adrian, thanks for taking the time to come on the podcast and share your insights.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the nice comments as well.
Let's talk about the resource sector first. Last year, as you peer back over 2018, can you recap for us some of the highlights, important events that you see and their significance?
You know, as I'm sure most of the listeners know, you know, most resources were down during the year. Resources are a tricky thing because all of the indices are different, and most of the indices are actually commodity indices, which will therefore include a lot of the soft commodities like grains and cattle and so on, which most of the people who follow resources are not really interested in. But nonetheless, most of them were down last year. The entire group was down 13%. And that's even though some of the soft commodities were up. But, you know, clearly the most important things were the continued strength in the dollar for most of the year, other things being equal, as we know, and things are never equal, but other things being equal, anytime you price something in dollars, if the dollar is strong, the dollar price of that commodity is weaker, obviously. The second major factor was the growing, ongoing tariff war between the U.S. and China in particular, and concerns that that might lead to a slowing global economy. So it's the tariff war itself, but it's also concerns of what it might lead to. And then, of course, the third thing was the step up in, I hate to call it tightening, but in interest rate increases by the Federal Reserve. As you know, they announced that they had stopped QE and were going to start tightening back in 2015, and we saw one small rate hike at the end of this 2015 in December, and then a whole year later we saw another one. So it's a very slow incoming, but last year we had four raises. And so it appeared, perhaps, that the Fed was going to continue pushing rates up. So all those three, and that, of course, also, not only is that raising the cost of capital for a capital-intensive industry, so that's a negative in and of itself, but secondly, the concern that raising rates too much might lead to a slowing economy again. So those three factors, I think, were the main things that just pushed commodities down, and they're all macro. You know, I'm not talking anything micro, because I think last year the macro, other than perhaps for oil, I think the macro was far more important than the micro last year.
Within the micro sector of the macro miners last year, we saw Barrick and Randgold merge. What's your commentary on their merger and its significance?
Well, it's interesting because there was, as you know, there was no premium offered. Barrick obviously approached Randgold. I think it means more to Barrick than it did to Randgold. But there was no premium offered, which was very unusual. And Barrick has suggested, and Bristow from Randgold has sort of echoed that, but we're likely to see more mergers, no premium mergers, as the industry consolidates. This is a very, very, for the size of the industry, it is an extremely fragmented industry, both among the seniors and even more so among juniors. Very, very fragmented. And that is inefficient because, if you have, 20 companies of a $2 billion size, you've got 20 managements to support. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Buran Gold Barrick. I know that's not what you were asking me about, but the most important thing to watch there, I think, is the difference in styles between Mark Bristow and Randgold and John Thornton and the Masters of the Universe of Barrick. It'll be interesting to see how, if they can consolidate or if there's going to be a culture clash. But that's a different question. I think we're going to see consolidation. We have to. We're going to see it among juniors as well. The difficulty always is, if you don't have strong asset synergies, right, then your synergies have to come, your benefits have to come from cost savings, which means reducing overlapping managements, essentially. And most people who run companies don't want to voluntarily give up their jobs. And that is, I think, the biggest problem we have in not rationalizing the industry, particularly at the junior side.
Unless there's a large premium and there's some incentive for management, a windfall, would you say, at the junior level, it's just that windfall that management would get that would cause them to acquiesce and give in to such a merger?
No, absolutely. And I think you're more likely to see that kind of premium when a company, let's say an exploration company, makes a discovery and another company wants that discovery because it's synergistic with something they have, and they'll offer a premium. I was thinking more, and I sort of don't particularly want to mention names because I'm not here thinking of any, I don't want anyone to get the wrong impression, but you look at a lot of, let's say, exploration companies that might be doing good work, but, just haven't made a discovery. And you might have a company, an $8 million market cap, a $12 million market cap, a $10 million market cap. Well, each of those companies has their own managements plus their own, regulatory requirements and everything else. And typically, if a company is a 10 million market cap, I would say typically 75% of the money they raise goes into overhead, not into the ground. So if you combine three or four or five companies of 10 million, 15 million each, first of all, you get something that's a little bit more liquid and therefore more open to more investors, or more investors are open to it. 200 million market cap, let's say, still small, but not micro. And maybe you can reduce, if you have a 200 million market cap, you can reduce 150 million overhead. You can reduce that to 100 or 75, which means more of the money you raise can actually go into the ground. And so it's not that any of these companies, in many cases, it's not that any of these companies are doing bad work or are crooks or are, that's a totally different issue. I'm talking about good companies with good managements doing good work. But if you're only 10 or 20 million market cap, inevitably you have to keep raising money, and inevitably a lot of that money, a majority of that money, has to go to just staying alive, regulatory fees, compliance fees, filing fees, et cetera, et cetera. And that's if they're not overpaying themselves or anything. Again, nothing I'm saying, we're not even getting to the companies where they overpay. We're just talking about good companies doing good work. But if they don't make a discovery, no one's going to offer them a premium. Why would you offer a premium to someone that doesn't have a discovery and doesn't offer you particular synergies? And so there's a lack of incentive for these companies to merge because nobody who went out, someone with 15 years with placidoma, and again, I'm not talking about anyone in particular. This is a hybrid individual, and he got tired of a big company, and he went out and started his own company and raised some money. He doesn't want to give up his company, and that's the problem.
Still talking about mergers and acquisitions, except from the investor's perspective and where they can find the best value in 2019. I've spoken to Rick Rule a couple times over the past year, and he points out that he thinks one of the most consistent and best opportunities for resource investors is trying to locate those takeover targets before they're taken out. Would you agree with that? And is that one of the places where you're looking for your investment dollars in 2019?
Well, far be it from me to disagree with Rick Rule. I think but how I see it is I look at potential takeovers as icing on the cake. So I rarely, not never, I rarely buy a company simply because I think it's going to get taken over, because all too often one can be disappointed, or it can just frankly just take too long before that comes to pass. But if I like a company, I like the management, I like the property, I like what they've got anyway, then a takeover can be icing on the cake. And I mean, we do have several companies we own, that I expect, that I'm fully expecting to get taken over at some point. And frankly, we had, over the last couple of years, we've had 4 or 5 that have been taken over. And we've got several, and I mean, you know, I don't know if you want names or not.
Yeah, please provide names. What's of interest to you? That was one of my questions. You make some of your positions public through your writings or through interviews like this. Can you comment on any of your positions that you've made public and what some of them that you think are the best value right now?
Yeah, I'll mention, on the junior side, I mentioned a couple, and this one gets back to takeover, Armadin. Armadin has a great project called Ixtaca in Mexico, Pueblo State. It's a gold-copper project. They've just completed a final feasibility. They've applied for permits. Armadin is a junior company, a very small company, good people. One would not typically expect them to put this project into production. It's a very low capex project, a very simple project to run metallurgically. So, you know, Armadin is suggesting that, in fact, they might put it into production themselves if they don't get an attractive enough offer, because it is a simple project and so on. So we own it because we like the project, we like the economics. I mean, the thing's selling at about a fifth of the value of, don't quote me on, it's even less than a fifth of the value of the feasibility study. At the same time, it's the kind of project that I wouldn't be surprised if someone was interested in taking over. 50% silver is very attractive to a lot of silver companies, where primary silver mines are, you know, increasingly rare. So this is an attractive project from that point of view, and it's in Mexico, which, despite, you know, everything about the new administration, Mexico still remains one of the best mining jurisdictions in the world. So I'm just looking this up. It's got an after-tax of value of $310 million. It's got a market cap of $80 million. So I think there's a lot of room there for someone to come in and take the company over. So, again, we don't own it just because we think it's going to get taken over, but we think there's, you know, a strong possibility that it might get taken over.
So you like royalty companies. That's well known. You often in many interviews talk about some of the larger billion-dollar plus royalty companies. But of recent years, there's been more of the smaller junior royalty companies come up. Can you talk about what you look for in a junior royalty company, and what are your general comments on the, let's say, sub 500 million market cap and below royalty space right now?
Yeah, good question. Well, the first thing I look for is the same thing I look for in any junior company, which is management. You've got to have a strong management, and strong management means obviously a lot of things. Management that can execute, a management that has a good business plan and has vision, can execute, can talk to the market, and so on. So that's number one. And number two is balance sheet. You want a company that is able to raise money because it has connections, does not overspend. That's important. And so when you're looking at the thing with royalties is there's a huge difference in valuation between a smaller royalty and a large royalty. So if you look at my favorite junior, which would be Metalla is a $70 million market cap. Let me just see what the we don't even have a PE ratio. We have a price to I'm just looking at a metric so we can compare. Price to cash flow of 26, and if we looked at Franco-Nevada, we get a price to cash flow of price to cash flow of about the same, but on other metrics, the bigger ones are a lot smaller. On the NAV, for example, on enterprise value, and so on. And so you want to buy you buy a junior rather than a senior because you think they have the ability to grow and the ability for that valuation to expand. So you want to look at a company that has been able to execute. Metalla, for example, has been around about a little over two years now. 2.5 years, and they've managed to get 4 producing royalties, a pipeline of about 14 or 15 in various stages, from exploration to developmental and near-term production. And in fact, they've actually introduced a dividend now. The dividend yield is about 2.3% right now. So it's an attractive dividend yield in and of its own right. It's unusual for a growing junior to pay a dividend.
Is that the smallest market cap company in the junior space that pays a dividend? You may not know it offhand, but that does strike me as well.
It's definitely one of. I know there's been one or two, but I think I had to stop the dividend because it just didn't make sense. In the case of Metalla, they're paying a percentage of their revenue as a dividend. So there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't be able to sustain paying a dividend. And I think the idea, again, it's unusual, but the idea was to show that the revenues that they had achieved from were actually sustainable. So you want a royalty that's growing and it can add various projects, and get a diversity of royalty income coming in. Again, as I mentioned, Metalla has 4 producing royalties. Franco has something like 43. So, I mean, it's a somewhat different scale. But the idea is that they will build up that revenue stream and the diversity of a revenue stream. And potentially this will be a takeover candidate at some point for a senior royalty company that has, difficulty adding to its royalty base. But that's maybe 2 or 3 years away from now. That's not an immediate prospect. I mean, we own Metalla right now because it's a solid company, good balance sheet, great management, and it's growing.
And would you say that the competition amongst those sub $500 million market cap junior royalty companies is stiffening, that it's more competitive for these deals?
It's getting more competitive. I mean, for the larger royalties, it's extremely competitive, as you know. They all look at the same things, Franco, Royal, Wheaton, and Osisko to a large degree, to some degree. But if a royalty is available, they're all looking at it, and no company is going to do a private deal on a $500 million royalty. It'll always go out to auction, or they'll talk to others. And frankly, who gets it depends really on who happens to have the cash at the time and for whom it most logically fits. You know, if someone's just done two big copper deals, you know, a gold byproduct from big Chilean copper mines, they may not be willing to pay up for another $1 billion Chilean copper mine byproduct credit royalty, if you understand what I mean. So it's just, but sometimes the returns on these deals at current prices are extremely low. There was one deal recently, a large deal, over $500 million, with a stated return of 1.1%. And it wasn't necessarily a bad deal. You know, it was a 60 or 70 year mine life, and it was a mine with a lot of upside potential. But nonetheless, that just gives you an indication of how competitive that sector is. When Metalla started, they were really able to, I think it's true to say that for smaller deals, it's sometimes able to do a transaction between a royalty company and a company without that project going out to auction to other companies. It has been possible. And so you see a particular company that you think you can do a transaction with, it's been possible to do it. But I think increasingly companies are wanting to shop their deals to other people, you know, to everybody. And there are more juniors out there. So that sector's going to get a little bit more competitive. But, you know, there aren't that many companies at the sub-100 million. You know, people often think of, say, Sandstorm as a small one. But Sandstorm's, you know, 850 million market cap. So it's small compared with Franco, but that's 10 times larger than Metalla. So at the moment, and I don't mean to keep harping on Metalla, but at the moment, a company of that size can be a lot more nimble than most of the market. And frankly, they can look at deals that other companies aren't interested in.
And I was talking to a mining engineer recently, and he said that even though investors looking at these deals may seek a 15% IRR, internal rate of return, there's not a lot of 15% internal rate of return projects out there. Would you agree with that?
For royalties or for projects generally?
For royalties in particular.
Definitely for royalties. No question. I mean, if you have a 15% IRR on a royalty that is acquired or created, there's probably something wrong with it, which might, you know, it might be in the Sudan or you know, whatever. 15, any double-digit rate of return on a royalty is pretty tough.
Adrian, before you go, I'd like to get your comments on copper. That's a metal that you like. 2 years ago when I first interviewed you, in fact, you told me that copper was your number one after the precious metals. What's your perspective on copper right now? We saw copper fall from about $3.30 a pound at the peak halfway through last year. Now it's close to 52-week lows, trading around $2.67 cents per pound. We have the trade talk and the trade truce, so supposedly between the U.S. and China right now. Can copper, in your opinion, fall even lower in 2019? We know that there's the supply deficit ahead of us here, you know, but what about copper in 2019? And in particular, what about the copper equities? Could the copper equities even go lower?
Well, things can always go lower. That's one of the things you certainly learn in the resource business, resource investing, that however cheap they appear, undervalued they appear, they can always go lower. Copper was interesting last year because, as you mentioned, copper actually had a quite strong first half of the year. So it really was, it struck me that copper was really beginning to turn around until the tariff trade dispute you know, really heated up, and that's what knocked it back. Copper remains, after gold, it remains my favorite metal and my favorite base metal, and it does face that near-term production deficit even without a pickup in demand. Now, of course, you don't want demand to collapse because of a global recession or a Chinese recession, but you don't need a great pickup in demand for copper to move into a deficit. And, you know, you look at big copper mines are very rare. One has to really emphasize this. a big copper mine is very, very rare. And Richard Ackerson, the CEO of Freeport, on the latest conference call, mentioned something really fascinating. Despite the fact that we had that super cycle from 2001 for 10 years, you know, when China was developing and all the base metals, including copper, were going crazy, not a single new copper mine has joined the list of top 10 producers or top 10 in reserves. Not a single one, despite the fact that we had that super cycle and despite the fact that people were spending money looking. Not only are they rare, but they take time to develop. Freeport has recently announced that apart from a couple of mines already in development, right, they are not given the go-ahead to any new mines until the copper price looks more certain. He said it would take a minimum of 5 to 7 years for another mine to commence production from the time they give the go-ahead. And the way he put it was, even a shovel-ready mine, 5 years minimum from the time the go-ahead is given. He indicated, and I think it's true, that stance of no new mines is true for most of the global, you know, major copper miners in the world. And so you can look ahead with a fair degree of certainty, a high degree of certainty, in fact, on what the potential production next year, the year after, 3, 4, 5 years from now, you can look ahead 5 years and with a high degree of certainty what the potential production is going to be, because there's going to be nothing producing copper in 2023, nothing that we don't already know about, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's a bigger chance of downside surprises. You know, some of the big copper mines start depleting quicker than we thought. There's an earthquake in Chile.
The union strikes.
Disruptions, union strikes, etc. So the surprises for copper production are likely to be on the downside, not on the upside. So, you know, absent a collapse in demand, we are going to see shortages in 3 or 4 years' time. And that's got to mean higher prices. We are accumulating copper companies. I think you do need a company with low-cost mines so they can withstand short-term weakness, continue to withstand any continued weakness. And a lot of these mining companies do have their own peculiar problems. But, I mean, we like Freeport a lot. That's the largest outside the Chilean government-owned Codelco. It's the largest publicly traded copper company in the world. Freeport, I think, is very, very cheap, and they've cleaned up the balance sheet tremendously. They've done a superb job at cleaning up the balance sheet. Lundin, which, again, has a great balance sheet. I wouldn't call Freeport's great, by the way. I just say they've done a good job cleaning it up. Mm-hmm. Lundin, on the other hand, Lundin Mining, does have a great balance sheet. They've got a lot of cash. They're in a position to buy something if something good comes along. As you know, they tried to buy the Timok and they tried to buy Nevsun, but that didn't work. They got trumped. And frankly, an unusual idea, I like Zijin, which is the Chinese company that purchased mm-hmm. Nevsun, the largest gold mining company in China, but a large diversified copper, a large diversified mining company. Gold is their largest asset, but copper is about half of what they have in gold, and they want to increase their copper, and they also have some zinc mines they've bought. They recently did a secondary offering just last week in order to finance the Nevsun purchase. Stock fell sharply from like nearly 320 down to 276. I think it's a good buy at today's price, and it pays a dividend 3% or something. 4% now, 4%, sorry, at today's price.
Adrian, if I could do one follow-up question on copper. You're a long-term investor, so you're not in it for short-term trading. But for the short-term trading speculators listening to us, with the trade negotiations between the U.S. and China occurring right now, do you think specifically the copper equities and the junior copper equities is what's being priced into those equities now? In other words, is there a lot of downside? If the trade talks fall apart between the U.S. and China, how much downside is still left in some of these depressed equities?
Good question. I don't think there's a lot of downside left anymore. You look at the major ones, and they are selling very close to their lows. You look at the juniors, which were slammed on tax loss selling, as well as the macro scenario we've discussed. I don't think there's a lot of downside left. I mean, obviously, if there was an abrupt end to trade talks with you know, some nasty tweets on either side, you know, the stocks would fall, no question. But I don't think there's a major sustained downside at this point.
Well, Adrian, before you go, is there any contact information or ways people could follow you?
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, the best thing is to look at the website first, which is www.adriandayassetmanagement.com. All one word, adriandayassetmanagement.com.
Well, Adrian, thank you for the conversation. I appreciate you joining me on the podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
For millennia, ancient pharaohs prospered from unparalleled riches made possible by Egypt's resource-rich gold deposits. But despite this rich history, modern Egypt remains one of the most underdeveloped gold mining countries in the world. But that's all about to change. Aton Resources is leading the charge on the Egyptian mining revival. As the only public exploration company in Egypt, Aton Resources has first-mover advantage. Focused on their 100% owned Abu Marawat concession, Aton Resources is advancing several exploration targets, including the recent discovery of the legendary Lost Mountain of Gold at Rod Ruin. Learn more about this exciting drill program and other news at AtonResources.com. Aton trades on the TSXV under the ticker symbol AAN and on the OTC under the ticker ANLBF. Thank you for listening to this Mining Stock Education podcast. Please subscribe and share with like-minded investors. Visit us on the web at miningstockeducation.com for more resources on precious metals and natural resource investing. At our website, you can also sign up for our free newsletter for interview transcripts, stock picks, and more. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.